We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Want to put your baseball skills to the test? Then get ready to show your stuff with MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Sign up for free for a chance to play your way to the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 World Series. Visit pitchhitrun.com today.
The Dan Bernstein Show. Weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Episodes 9 and 10 of ESPN's The Last Dance are going to air on Sunday. On Monday, what we call our Bulls Mondays, Will Perdue is going to co-host alongside. We'll talk to Lou Kanellis as well. And this has been great for us in the sports desert to have these shared experiences. And on Monday, we were able to have a conversation with the director of The Last Dance, Jason Hayer. And we talked to him at length, starting by asking about how we're watching this and how this plan differed from their initial plan of how the episodes were going to be presented.
No, it would have been two episodes per night, but it would have been on the off nights of the finals. So this was scheduled to premiere on June 2nd, and I think the finals began on June 4th, or were supposed to begin on June 4th, and that was going to be every other night. So they were checkerboarded throughout the finals, but it was always going to be two per night.
Yeah, we talked a lot about sort of what we're watching, about the nature of the storytelling. And we heard what Ken Burns said, and I know that you and he had talked since. We spoke with Andrea Kramer at length about how she viewed this per the standards of HBO Sports, et cetera. And I heard you say this. You said, what I do is journalistic, but I'm not a journalist. What we do is tell stories. So what I'd love to know, what's the difference?
Well, it doesn't mean that we're any less honest or truthful. But I think that when I said that we do things that are journalistic, but we're storytellers, any sports documentary is going to go through the filter of first of all, the league in which the subjects played. So if it's MLB, NBA, NHL, NFL, MLS, any of these things have a governing body. And you're licensing footage from those governing bodies, so they're going to have editorial input. Now, and I've been through this process many times with the NCAA and any governing body. There's going to be a back and forth. And they're trying to protect their brand, but you also hope that you're dealing with people at whatever governing body it is that understand that you need to tell all sides to a story and be comprehensive. And so that's what I meant by, you know, the standards for PBS are much more stringent than the standards for an HBO or an ESPN. PBS, if there's any underwriter of a project that has any connection to that subject at all, they are immediately disqualified from being an underwriter on the project. When Ken Burns and I spoke, he was telling me about some projects he had done, and it was like a third cousin of you know, Henry David Thoreau or somebody, and all of a sudden they couldn't be involved with the project because they were related to the person. So their standards are a lot more stringent than ESPN's, but it's not like we're not telling a responsible story. I think that Will could tell you when he watches these things, I hope he can tell you that we're trying to be as accurate and truthful as we possibly can. And, you know, I think the criticism that's prevalent is, well, Michael gave permission, so he's going to have final say on these things. That's true. It's also 100% true that he never once pushed back on anything, either on or off camera. He never said, you can't ask me about this. He and his team never said that. He never said, you have to take this out of this cut. I don't like this. The only notes that he gave were to add a couple of things in, and that was to add more color to the story. Like, for instance, you saw last night, that buzzer beater he hit against the Hawks in between the Indiana and the double nickel game during the 95 comeback, he saw the initial cut, and we went right from Indiana to Madison Square Garden. And he said there was a game in between there where I hit a buzzer beater, and that's when I knew that I could be my old self. So we added that in. Those are the kind of notes that he was giving, but it certainly wasn't to police the truth.
Jason, I will say this, and people keep asking me, you know, how accurate is this? What's going on? Is this really true? And I said, you know, they've done a really, really good job of depicting what it was like to be on those teams, to play with them. So I want to congratulate you on that. But I wanted to ask you, you said I'm surprised that Michael was going to allow some of this material, meaning what's coming up in episode 7 and 8, to be released. Why did you feel like he was trying to protect an image, or when he told you you guys could play that with no qualms, you made it sound like you were stunned?
I was surprised. You know, I never spoke to him at all during the process of the making of this. I just assumed, you know, you might have the most inflammatory moment in episode 7. You call him an a-hole. And, you know, I thought that he might bristle at that, or that his people might say, okay, like, this is over the top. You don't need to call him an a-hole and a jerk and show him behaving this way. One clip can do it. You don't need to show three clips. But even, you know, he's calling Joe Klein, you big fathead MF-er. I mean, there are things that we put in there, like, all right, let's see how far we can push this. And they didn't take anything out. So that's when I said I was surprised. I just went into this entire process expecting the worst and hoping for the best. And when I say that, I mean expecting it to be really policed. And you know, Michael has an image that's been crafted over the course of decades. And I know that people protect that image. It's worth a couple of $1 billion. So I was afraid that we were going to, there's going to be people a lot more over our shoulder and policing what we said and how we said it a lot more. But episode 7 is, you know, the proof is in the pudding, that there's a lot of stuff in there that, yeah, I'm sure must have hurt to hear. Maybe he laughed when you probably called him an a-hole to his face a couple of times, I'm sure. And you know Michael better than any of us do. So you would know what he would allow and what he wouldn't. Maybe you're surprised that I was surprised because you know Michael well enough and you know that he would have no problem with people expressing those kind of opinions.
Well, I will say this. I remember when I got the phone call and was asked to do this, and I thought about it and I said, listen, and I did my interview in February of last year, 2019, and I said, we're old enough now that we can look back on this, and if these guys are going to do this correctly, we have to be honest. You know, we're not trying to convey some type of image. And if people don't like what I'm going to say, then there's always the adage, well, sometimes the truth hurts. But that's just how he was. Now, I've learned and accepted that and appreciated that to all levels as I've gotten older because of how it changed me and how much I gained from playing for him and playing for the Bulls. But I was curious with you, A, the idea you had going into making this, because you already had that footage from the NBA, but B, how many times did you change direction because of what you were getting and the valuable information that was coming in from these individual interviews?
That's a great question, and it was the interviews that drove the creative process here. We knew that footage was going to be the backbone of this whole series, and that's why it's called The Last Dance, and that's why everything is seen through the lens of that 97-98 season. But without the honesty and candor of guys like you and all of your teammates, we're not having this conversation because I think that it wouldn't have resonated with anybody. If you want to go see highlights of Michael Jordan and the 90s Bulls, you can go to YouTube, and there's, you know, roughly 6 million clips you could sit there and watch from now until the end of the year. But in order to actually tell the story, you needed the kind of honesty that you brought. You know, my favorite, I think my favorite anecdote in the entire series is the one that you told about the dollar blackjack game. I think that says so much about not only Michael, but about you and about BJ, and just you with, in telling that story, it was so vivid. You put us on that airplane with you guys in telling that story. And that's the one where you said, why do you want to play with us? We're playing a dollar a hand and you're playing for thousands in the back of the plane. And he said, it's not about the dollar. It's about your money in my pocket. And that's Michael Jordan that I've come to know in my research. That's him to a T.
Did he ever say to you, Sorry, Dan, but I was
the director.
Did he ever say to you, "This isn't good enough. You need to ramp it up here. This isn't what we've talked about"?
Yeah, not indirectly. As I said, I never spoke with him, but you know, all of the partners in this are perfectionists, and that includes me and my team as well. But there is a sense of, you know, 9 out of 10 is not good enough. I remember we got a note back from someone on his executive team that episode 1, it's good, it's an A, but it can be an A+, and here's how we should do it. And we just had ongoing talks. It took us, you know, over a year and a half to get episodes 1 and 2 locked in. And that's because we had that much time. If this thing was going to air next year, we'd still be editing 1 and 2 and still be trying to hone it and perfect it as much as we can. Those things were only done because they were due at the time. It's not because we felt, all right, this is perfect. We always were honing things, and that comes from the top down. It certainly is an attitude that he has about anything he's going to be involved in. It's you do it the best all the time, or why bother doing it at all?
Last Dance director Jason Heyer is our guest here on Sports Radio 670 The Score. Dan Bernstein alongside Will Perdue. When we see that moment when Jordan says break, when he's talking about his philosophy and essentially his ruthlessness, and he says he needs a break, what were those emotions? What's behind those bloodshot eyes at that moment? Is that a personal realization that maybe he didn't like about himself? Was it just a manifestation of overall intensity of emotion? I'm still trying to, I couldn't determine exactly why his circuit breakers tripped at that moment. What do you think happened?
It's a question for him, of course. I can't speak for him, but I think that you can glean some knowledge out of the question that spawned it. And that was that I was curious, in my brief interactions with him, he was a nice guy. He was very respectful to me, to our crew. He couldn't have been a nicer guy when he was around us. Now, I understand you're going to be polite and professional, and it's not like I'm friends with him. But I was interested in a guy who seems normal, and, you know, he's kind of a ball buster. He liked giving it to the guys, and we gave it back to him, and he just likes being in settings like that. He seemed, you know, quote-unquote normal to me, especially for someone who's a global icon. He was pretty down to earth. And I wondered if it bothered him that the first thing people thought about him is, you know, intense, insatiable hunger, drive to win at all costs. And, you know, when I would mention to people that I was doing this doc a couple of years ago when we were first starting out, they'd say, oh, you're going to talk about when he punched Steve Kerr, when he punched Will Perdue, you're going to talk about didn't he get suspended by David Stern? Wasn't he responsible somehow for his dad's death? There's all kinds of rumors out there and all kinds of you know, aspersions that people have cast. And I wondered if that bothered him. I think that he gets passionate and emotional about two things, his family and winning. And he takes both of those things so seriously that they're paramount to everything else in his life. And he is adamant that everyone had to go through what he went through to get those titles. It took 7 long years for him to win that first one. And Will can tell you better than anybody how much that affected him and how much he needed that. So I think when he talks about his passion, it makes him really emotional because there's that fire is still there inside of him. So there's moments in this thing where you can see the old MJ come to life, and that was one of them.
Jason, what was your initial thought when you were like, okay, I'm going to do this, and this is – I got to try to take the personal out of it, meaning this is what I think about MJ. But as you're going through this and as you're constantly going through these hours and hours and hours of tape, you just mentioned normal, down to earth, intense, win at all costs, family and winning. But what have you walked away from thinking, I didn't know this, people didn't know this, and they're going to be stunned to learn this?
Maybe not stunned, but I didn't know how hard it was for you guys from season to season. It, you know, everyone knows it's difficult to win a title, and any good coach will tell you that it's harder to win back-to-backs than it is to win the first one. But it's easy with 20 or 30 years of hindsight to say, yeah, they were the best team in the 90s. Look at the roster that they had. They were incredible. They had Robin. They had Pippen to go along with Michael. They had Phil Jackson, who's one of the best coaches of all time. They had a fantastic supporting cast. I think when you examine it year by year, you see how often it could have gone off the rails, especially during that second three-peat run. I mean, they were exhausted. They were lucky. Not lucky, but they were fortunate that it didn't go to a game seven in 98, because I don't know if they would have won that game. But I think just the drive, the commitment, the hard work that's necessary to do it year after year after year. You know, Pat Riley talks about the disease of more, and that when you win one, everyone wants more adulation, more credit, more money, more playing time, more power. And so to keep on coming back year after year and keep that same formula where everyone knows their role is very, very, very hard to do. I don't think that you'll ever see six championships in 8 years in the NBA ever again. So what I came away with it was just having such a profound respect for you guys and how hard it is to do year after year.
If right now you could sit down with Jerry Krause and have as many hours as you wanted to square the circle of this story in any way, what would be your line of questioning? What would you want to know, and how would you want to know it?
I'd love to know how he would articulate the perception of him is in the public, what he thinks people think of him, and why that is correct or probably why that is incorrect, how he's been cast as the villain in this. I would want to know from him what regrets he had and what he would stand by from what he did and how he acted in the 90s and the, you know, the decisions that he made. You know, I think that he will never get enough credit. And it's a shame that he only got it when he's no longer here. You know, when someone wants credit that much and it's so transparent, people are reluctant to give it to them because you're not supposed to openly say, well, I did this. But he's no longer with us, and I think he should be, his family and his friends should be immensely proud of his accomplishments. You know, Michael was there when he got there. Every other piece, he put that into place. So, you know, they are quite simply not there without Jerry. I firmly believe that. Michael clearly was the straw that stirred the drink. He is the guy that, he's the alpha and the omega in the Bulls universe. But without Jerry's expertise, we're not having this conversation. So, you know, I wish we could have sat down with him because I had so many questions for him. But the main one would be why? Why do this? Why go to Phil Jackson before a season and say you can go 82-0 and you're still not coming back? Why drop that hammer the first day of training camp? Why would you enter a season with casting that pall over your team? What was it that you were so passionate about that made you say that you would want to blow this thing up that you had built? So it would have been fascinating because Jerry's a smart guy, and I'm sure he would have had a lot of answers for me.
Jason, listen, we have two more episodes left. And I think, again, you guys have done a great job. What happened with Scottie Pippen in the huddle happened, and I think it needed to be in the documentary. But I wanted to ask you, as a guy that played with Scottie, and maybe this happens in episodes 9 and 10, I don't think, and this, I'm not trying to be too critical, but is there something that's going to happen in 9 and 10 that really tells us how good Scottie Pippen is? Because, you know, you can't include everything. You know, you're seeing on Twitter, people are like, listen, I wish there were 100 episodes. But you had to cut some things. Was there some stuff about Scottie that you wish you could have included more of, but because of a time commitment, you didn't? Or is there something coming up in 9 and 10 that give him the necessary credit that I think he deserves? I know in 1 and 2, Michael talked about without Scottie, there is no Michael Jordan winning six championships.
Mm-hmm. I think the answer to those questions both is yes. Yes, I wish we could have done more for every player. Ron Harper, we barely even got to mention in this series, and I think that Ron probably didn't get a fair shake in this because we just didn't have the time. Tony Kukoc, we could have done a lot more about him and all of the challenges he had when he came over, you know, language barriers to European ball to NBA pro ball is really hard. And he had a very tough few years when he first got over here. So there's a ton of stories that I wish we could have told. I will say that Scottie's toughness, you're going to learn a lot about that in episode 10. And I'm proud of the job that we did, and I'm immensely thankful to the NBA for the way that they covered Game 6, cameras everywhere. And Scotty was in and out of the trainer's room for that entire game, and he was a decoy for the entire game in Game 6 against Utah. He could barely move. Anyone who's pulled their back out, even playing pickup ball, knows that it's debilitating, and it knocks you off your feet for days at a time. And Scotty was playing with a pulled, wrenched back that entire game. He was having back problems for months going into the game, and was getting treatment right up until tip-off. And then the first play of the game, he dunks, and when he comes down, his back goes out. And you can kind of see that heel-toe walk that people do when they could barely stand up when their back is in spasm. He was in spasm for the entire game, and he grit his teeth, and he played through it because that's how valuable he was as a player, that even as a decoy, he attracted enough attention on the court that it gave Michael the space to operate. So, you know, I can't say that if you're disappointed that Scotty didn't get his due, that you will be satiated once you see this thing. But I can say that we did all we could to show just how tough a competitor Scotty is, and you'll see that next week.
Jason, last question. Really appreciate you being generous with your time today. You mentioned you would ask Jerry Krause about regret, and it's a very heavy word, especially when we're talking about, like you say, six trophies, and we get this sense of the ends justifying the means. But I'm noticing a theme in a lot of this is a lack of regret. It's unapologetic stances from Isaiah Thomas, from Jordan, from Pippen, even for refusing to come in the game. He acknowledges it was bad, but doesn't say that he would do it differently. They come close to remorse, regret, apology, but never quite get. What is it about great athletes? What is it about how this becomes, how their story becomes so much of who they are, that there's never a sense of, yeah, I would have done that differently, or yeah, I kind of feel bad about doing that. I shouldn't have done that. Nobody apologizes for anything in this.
I think it's pride. You know, these guys, as I mentioned before, the level to which you have to work is staggering to get to where these guys were. This is the pinnacle of their sport. These are the best on the planet in the NBA. You know, Michael, when he told that LeBradford Smith story, said that the lesson he learned was that on any given night, anybody in the league can go off like that. Because if you make it to the league, there are bench warmers, but there are no guys who aren't world-class in that league. So a guy like Scotty, who has made it to the pinnacle of that league, coming from where he came from, I think he's got an enormous amount of pride that he was doubted his entire life until he got to the NBA. And indeed, when he was in the NBA, he still was doubted. He was still kind of the Robin to Michael's Batman, as Mike Wilbon said in the doc. So I think it's very difficult to look back and say, yeah, I regret that. I should have done that differently. That takes someone that takes honest regret from your heart, and it takes a big person to admit that. So maybe he didn't regret it at all, and maybe a lot of these guys don't regret that stuff. I think that Isaiah, as he said, we would have done it differently if we knew what the backlash was going to be, but that's not the same as regret, as you pointed out. So I think a lot of these guys are proud men, and they got to where they got through hard work and through sticking to their guns, and it's difficult for them to act any other way.
Last Dance director Jason Hayer, who was on The Score Monday on our Bulls Monday that we have been doing after the episodes of The Last Dance air, and we will be doing it again on Monday. Will Perdue will be sitting in. We've added Andrea Kramer to our list of guests, joining Lou Kanellis and more, as we break down not just the last two episodes, but the totality of The Last Dance and what it's meant and what we have seen. Also, Danny Parkins is going to be part of an immediate reaction show on Sunday night on The Score, so you'll be able to tune in then. If you're up and interested and motivated, he will be there for you. We've got some hockey talk coming up next. Mark Lazarus wrote about a forgotten Blackhawks executive who probably shouldn't be. And it seems like he got kind of a raw deal when he was here in Chicago and on the way out of Chicago. And I think it's interesting in the context of their current front office shakeup or ongoing shakeup after the removal of John McDonough. So we will talk about all of that with Mark Lazarus. He's always a good guest, and he had some really cool stuff in The Athletic. So that's straight ahead. I'm Dan Bernstein. You have The Score.
McNeil and Parkins, afternoons 2 to 6 on The Score.
MLB Network's John Morosi.
Spring training starts on June 10th, which has been reported and mentioned in different places, with the regular season around the 4th of July. You really have to have an agreement in place by the end of the month just to get everybody reported in time. And so that's why I believe they've purposely given themselves a couple weeks to work through the details of this.
Listen to McNeil and Parkins on your ride home 2 to 6 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. A radio Sports Station. This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
Here's Campbell handing on to Kane again. Lots of head fakes there trying to shake team in it. Threw one in front. It rattled around and it kicked on back and it scored. We saw no light. We saw no signal. And we're not sure if they've set a signal of a goal yet, but they are celebrating at the other end of the ice. What chaos. Word has gotten to the Blackhawks what you have just seen. One of the more unusual finishes, but it's a goal. The Stanley Cup to the Chicago Blackhawks.
The famous phantom goal. And there were some celebrators out there. There were some people enjoying that one who got to the Blackhawks in a way that I really didn't know until I read this article in The Athletic by our next guest, Mark Lazarus, who is on Twitter, at Mark Lazarus. He is on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Laz, how are you, man?
I'm good, Dan. How are you?
I'm good. I enjoyed your piece on former general manager Mike Smith, because I'll be honest, I didn't know that he was responsible for being the guy who would roll the dice with Duncan Keith. I didn't know that Dustin Byfuglien was his guy. I didn't know that they knew how slow Brent Seabrook was, that he still took him anyway. What inspired you to want to tell that story?
Well, it's funny, like a lot of people in Chicago, there's kind of a black hole in my Blackhawks knowledge. The 3 years that Mike Smith was GM were the 3 years I was covering the Penguins out in Pittsburgh for a small suburban paper, my first few years out of school. So I didn't really know much about it. So every time I looked at these, you know, in the draft history, which I do a lot, especially this time of year, I always was amazed that we always hear about, well, is it Dale Talon or is it Stan Bowman? Who gets the most credit for these cup runs? And you look at Duncan Keith, Brent Seabrook, Corey Crawford, Dustin Byfuglien. These are some huge figures. And some guy named Mike Smith drafted them all. So I tracked him down. I called him up. And I was planning on just writing about that 2003 draft. But as you saw in the story, he's not shy. And it very quickly became something else entirely.
Well, and as it did, I'm just mindful of what we're looking at now and what Rocky Wirtz is trying to figure out about how he wants his front office to run. Because Mike Smith painted a picture of extreme dysfunction, having to have Bob Pulford sign off on things. And I'm sure in the case of Duncan Keith, the idea of having a small, fast, skilled defenseman didn't square with the old defenseman must be big and strong and Canadian kind of thing. Like, they had some pretty set in their ways of theories of looking at some of these things. What lessons do you think are there to be learned for the new Blackhawks and going forward from, boy, just the messed up way things seem to work?
Well, yeah, I mean, it adds some color to the idea that this was the worst franchise in professional sports. I mean, you know, the coach hated the GM, the GM hated the players, hated the coach hated the players, the GM hated the vice president trying to get the GM fired, and the owner just let it all happen because he didn't care. And, you know, Pulford was his guy. And now Mike Smith was hardly like a perfect GM. He made some terrible decisions. His fascination with Russians, that people call them Smithov. And you look at like picks like Anton Babcock, there's just as many bad picks in there as there are good picks. That's the NHL draft for you. But the whole organization was just a complete mess. And I think that's what, you know, when you bring in a guy like John McDonough in 2007, kind of straightens that up. Now, don't get me wrong. John McDonough meddled in hockey affairs. He would sign off on things. He wasn't strictly a business president. He had his hand in hockey ops from time to time. And whoever comes in next is probably going to be the same thing. It's very hard to really have a separation of church and state there. But at the early 2000s Blackhawks, I mean, every time I learn more about them, I'm just blown away by how poorly run they were and what just a complete disaster of a franchise they were.
It also didn't help that Mike Smith was kind of odd. He's just he's a really different guy. His conversational rhythm, it takes some getting used to. And famously, we still talk about it, that years ago he did an interview. I want to say it was the Mike North Show. It was in the middle of the day. And he did a radio phone interview while eating carrot sticks.
And it's just and it's just this, like, who does that? It was like these loud crunch, 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 and just punctuating everything he said. And it didn't bother him. And we're looking at each other like, is this guy for real?
Hockey's a sport that really does, that really values conformity. Everyone's milquetoast, everyone's vanilla, everyone's the same way. It's why, remember, was it Dougie Hamilton, I think? He wound up getting traded because he likes going to museums, was one of the stories that was weird, that he liked going to museums. Brendan Perlini, when he came to Chicago, was considered a weird guy because he liked to read hockey. And Mike Smith, he collected Native American art. He had like an 1880s printing press in his office. He was a different guy. And that's not how it's – and then to come throw in the fact that he was favoring Russian players over good Western Canadian boys, and it rubs a lot of the old guard the wrong way. I mean, it's different now. It's better now. People, it's a more global sport. It's more open-minded front offices throughout the league, but not entirely. But back then, 20 years ago, he was like an alien coming in there. And, you know, when you take a guy like Bob Pulford, who is just your classic quote-unquote hockey man, there's obviously going to be some conflict between two guys like that.
And I love the Dustin Byfuglien stuff, how they kept trying to reconcile that, yes, he's fat. However, he's also good. That the things are not mutually exclusive. You know, and I don't know, because I don't know hockey like other sports either, if there are comps for that. As scouts would say, well, he's like so-and-so. He was fat and he was good. And this is a, I keep imagining, you know, Cartman saying, I'm not fat, I'm big boned. And but it somehow they acknowledged it and took a flyer on him, and it worked. He was a really important part of a champion.
Yeah, I mean, they took him in the eighth round, which doesn't even exist anymore. That's how late in the draft it was. There's only seven rounds now in the draft. But, you know, I was just out of school covering hockey back then, 2001, 2002, 2003. And I was covering the Penguins. Mario Lemieux, he looked like he had a dad bod. I mean, back then, hockey players didn't have to be these chiseled-cut specimens that they are now. You know, weightlifting wasn't that big. It was all about agility and just skill. Now it's much more about physical fitness and strength, and, you know, they're all doing their Pilates and their core work and all that. But back then, I mean, I don't know if there was a lot of fat guys, but it wasn't that unusual for a guy to be genuinely out of shape and still playing in the NHL. It was different skills that were required. If you're Mario Lemieux and you're that size and that talented, it didn't matter if you were cut, if you were just that good. But, yeah, Dustin Byfuglien, he's still a big guy. He's always been a big guy. He's in good shape, though. I mean, he's a professional athlete. But back then, he was, for a 17-year-old, who's a fat kid.
And understanding that Duncan Keith, despite being small, that there was an awareness of where the game was headed, that things were happening in hockey. The game was changing. It was going to become much more speed and skill, I think, and for all good reasons in that regard. But like you say, those forces of the bias toward Canadians, was that purely a Pulford thing, or was Pulford manifesting a
larger
hockey thought?
That's hockey for decades. They wouldn't even take American players long ago because they only wanted Canadian players. I mean, that's just, he's run by good old Canadian boys for decades and decades. It's, like I said, it's different. Now you have a Finnish GM in Columbus, like Jarmo Kekalainen. I mean, it's not like that anymore. But back then, even 20 years ago, it was a Canadian sport, and it was always going to be a Canadian sport. So there was some pushback. And, you know, Mike Smith, he was kind of ahead of his time. He was an early adopter of analytics. I mean, he sort of, you know, he made some outlandish claims when we were talking. He basically said that he founded analytics, basically, the concept of it, and that, you know, eight out of the 10 Stanley Cup champions in the 2010s used his analytics. I don't know what that means exactly, but he was certainly ahead of his time in the way he thought the game. He saw the way the Russians played the game, the speed, the skill, kind of like Herb Brooks did in 1980, and said, that's where the game is going. And, you know, it at that point, it really was. I mean, the game, you know, you look at a guy like Patrick Kane. Could Patrick Kane, the singular talent that he is, what would he have looked like in the 1970s, the 1980s? He would have just gotten pulverized out there. He's probably good enough that he could have, you know, avoided contact to a degree and still scored a ton of points, but he would have been murdered out there. He would have got a stick to the skull. So the game was changing around then, coming out of the 2004 lockout. That's when it really changed wholesale.
And we should mention he took Corey Crawford as well. But some of these biases, you know, implicit and explicit biases that were going on in scouting departments, I would say this, that were Duncan Keith not Canadian, he probably wouldn't have gotten drafted. I mean, that's amazing.
Well, it's funny because we talk about all this, but you look at Mike Smith's drafts. and all the Europeans and Russians didn't pan out, and all the Canadian boys did. So maybe they were right.
That's right. Yeah, maybe they figured something out. What are you hearing as we let you go about any next steps for the Blackhawks front office and who's going to be in charge of this draft?
It sounds to me like the whole idea of this early June draft seems to be fading, thankfully. This idea of having a draft before the season even ends seems to be – there was so much pushback from the GMs that the league seems to be backing down. So the Hawks feel like they have a lot of time here. I mean, it's going to be a long time before a real offseason gets here, whether they cancel the season or have some kind of playoff that might actually include the Blackhawks, because a 24-team playoff it seems to be the front runner, according to Pierre LeBrun. So there's a lot of time here. So they're kind of – from what I understand, they're so tight-lipped about this, it's incredible. But they're really taking time to take stock and see what they want to do, how they want to go forward. And they have time. This is the only time they'll ever have this kind of luxury of time. If this is a regular season, they'd have the draft coming up. They'd have the agency coming up. But everything is kind of just stopped. So they have the ability to take their time and really think out what they want to do. And that's you're not getting any developments here because they're not taking any steps yet. It's been all internal negotiations so far.
Mark, appreciate the time. What I want you to do is I want you to follow up because I want to know about Mike Smith's beehives now that he's apparently a farmer / beekeeper.
I wanted to use it, but it was all blurry and it was a bad photo, so I couldn't use it.
Now, I want to know how that all goes, because apparently from the stories that we've done here on the Midday Midway, there's a lot of money to be made in beekeeping if you've got the stomach for it. People steal those things. There's all the whole California controversy of people stealing other people's beehives. So hope he's got them on lockdown. Appreciate it, Mark. Have a really good weekend, man. Continue good health.
Thanks, Dan. You too.
That is Mark Lazarus of The Athletic joining us on Sports Radio 670. There's something really cool that is going on tomorrow, and it is a charity streaming event that is being put together by the Chicago CEO COVID-19 Coalition. It's going to be musical performances and comedy and appearances, all to raise money for a large group of charities here in Chicago. And one of the organizers of that is filmmaker Bob Title, the guy behind the Barbershop movies, and a good dude, and put a lot of effort into this with help from Wintrust Bank and Calamos Investments. And he's going to join us to give us all the information about this fundraiser tomorrow. He's coming up next on The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
My day, Barber was a counselor, a fashion expert, style coach, pimp, just general all-around hustler. But the problem with y'all cats today is that you got no skill, no sense of history. And then, with a straight face, got the nerve to want to be somebody, want somebody to respect you. But it take respect to get respect. Understand? See, I'm old, but Lord willing, I'd be spared the sight of seeing everything that we had worked it for flushed down the drain by someone who don't know no better or care. Let's come right on off this.
Yes, right.
See, this smooth. When he get through, his face gonna be real smooth like Gary Coleman.
And we can also pray that we can go back to a barbershop at some point. Oh, my God. All of us. I'm starting to look like Doc Brown from Back to the Future. This is getting awful. But that was indeed from the movie Barbershop. That was created by our next guest on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Bob Title is joining us because he is one of the forces behind a terrific and entertaining event that is scheduled for both streaming and broadcast on NBC Sports Chicago tomorrow starting at 5 o'clock. It's called Sweet Home Chicago Relief and Recovery Streaming Event, put together by the Chicago CEO COVID-19 Coalition. Bob, thanks for joining us. I know this has been a labor of love for you.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for having me. And by the way, I got to tell you, I loved hearing that clip by Cedric. That was brought back a lot of great memories.
Oh, I'm sure it did. This is quite the lineup that you have put together here. I can't read all of these names, but Common, Jeff Tweedy, Chicago, Jamila Woods, the SNL superfans, a bunch of 85 Bears, Buddy Guy, oh, Tim Kazurinski, Vic Mensa, Zach LaVine, Patrick Kane, Tony Kukoc, Bob Odenkirk, Donnie Wahlberg. I mean, it's really a remarkable group of people all getting together. What do we need to know about how we can help raise money for these causes?
Well, listen, it's a great lineup. There's been a lot of people behind this putting it together. Everybody's been putting, you know, the time in around the clock. It was started by John Kalamos, John Cadonis, that is, with Kalamos Investment Group. And they put together, wanted to do this thing and get back to Chicago. So we rallied all our Chicago talent, and they got behind this right away. It's got a great sports lineup. It's going to go, you know, like you said, on NBC Sports. But you could also go to www.chicc.org to stream it. And, you know, we're raising a lot of money. It's for 10 different charities. The money goes directly to those charities. So it's really a great cause. And like you said, there's a lot of great people, a lot of surprises. Just to get the Chicago superfans and Dicka back was such a treat. You know, watching the 85 Bears, you know, with McMichael, Wilson, and Butler, you could just sense the love those guys have for one another. And it just, you know, for me, I was in high school, a senior in high school when that happened, and it feels like yesterday after listening to those guys. And then obviously with The Last Dance going on, we get a little bit of that too, which is great.
It's a great range.
Yeah,
yeah, I was going to say the great range of people that are involved, representing numerous sports and numerous musical genres. It's also an outstanding range of charitable recipients. And just so people know, we're talking about the Chicago Community COVID-19 Response Fund, the Greater Chicago Food Depository, Salvation Army Metro Division, the Knight Ministry, Catholic Charities, Greek Orthodox Metropolis, the Jewish United Fund, Metropolitan Family Services, the Howard Brown Health Center, and the 100 Club of Chicago. So you guys did a really conscientious job making sure that that so many people and so many aspects of the city are going to be helped.
Yeah, it was great. We focused on four topics, right? Food, homelessness, PPE, and the community mental health. And we hope that this just is not just one night tomorrow, that it's going to continue afterwards.
To give people the information, again, if they go to chicc.org, that there will be an opportunity to donate through there.
Correct.
And you can also watch on NBC Sports Chicago. So I know the driving force is, too, that this doesn't happen without Kalamos Investments or our friends at Wintrust Bank. And it takes some of those heavy hitters to lead the way.
You know, to their credit, they sparked this thing to get it going. John did. Cadonis, and they just made a great effort, and you know, it was a great reach. And once they said what they wanted to do and how they wanted to help people, it was kind of easy to gather people. You know, everybody came on board. How can you say no at a time like this? You know what I mean?
Bob, wish you the best of luck. I hope this goes great. I think it's terrific that you're doing this, and I know that the Score and Entercom Chicago have been proud to help out with it in any way we can.
Yeah, you guys have been great, and thank you to everybody out there, and look forward if you guys get a chance to watch it tomorrow at 5 p.m.
Bob, appreciate your time. Good luck.
Thanks, Dan.
That is Bob Title, who is one of the many people working hard to bring you the Sweet Home Chicago Relief and Recovery streaming event. It is going to be tomorrow evening, starting at 5 o'clock. All those performers, all of those athletes, information at chicc.org. Like to send out some thank yous to all who joined us today. Bruce Levine was with us. Bob Title was with us. Mark Lazarus also as well. Another terrific week. Looking forward to another fantastic Bulls Monday with Will Purdue sitting next to me. Well, theoretically next to me anyway. Andrea Kramer is going to join us once again from HBO Real Sports. We're going to talk to Lou Kanellis again, and we're going to find out what you think of The Last Dance in its entirety and in those final two episodes. Thanks to Jay Zawoski for his hard work as our executive producer, and thanks to Ray Diaz as well. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being a part of the show. And if you're wearing a mask, as you should when you're outside or outside of your home and indoors, wear it over your nose, because if you don't wear it over your nose and mouth, you are not wearing a mask. Things are looking better every day because we're doing what we're doing. Keep washing your hands. Keep making sure you keep proper distance from people. Be smart about things. Wipe down surfaces. You know what to do. Listen to doctors, and only listen to people who listen to doctors. Have a safe and healthy weekend. Try to take a walk. Get a deep breath. Do some yard work. We'll be back again after The Last Dance to talk on Monday. Have a good weekend.
Hey, Lawrence Holmes here. Being live and local with 670 The Score is more important than ever. So as America adjusts to the new work-at-home environment, trust us to keep you informed, entertained, and perhaps have a laugh or two along the way. Just tell your smart speaker to play 670 The Score from radio.com and stream The Score live from your smart speaker instantly. 670 The Score is live and local, a radio.com sports station.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.